Good to see everybody here today. We've got lots of visitors with us today. We're delighted to have y'all here. We have a meal right after the services today, probably about 20 minutes after the services. If you can stay and join us, we would love you to be for you to be able to do that. But if you can't, stick around for a minute or two and let us get to know you a little bit better. Good to have our old friends back with us. They're young friends, mind you, but they've been friends for a long time. But good to have Jimmy and Vanelle and their boys and their families. Good to see just each one of them. We've got some new neighbors in town. Y'all be sure and meet them before you head out. I think their names are Todd and Kimberly, but it could be Bob and Alice. But I know that the son's name is Calvin because Calvin is my hero. And so y'all meet them if you get a chance. They've just moved into I believe it's Zach's old house. So no, it wasn't either. It was Jay and Amber's old house right across the alley. But good to have y'all here. Good to have each one of y'all here today that are always so faithful to be here. I want to talk about the little things today and how important they can be. It's interesting to me how when you take care of the small things, how well things seem to go. But when you let the little things get by, the problems you can have. When I was in college, I guess it's probably my sophomore year, because my brother wasn't with me, and I was glad for that. But I wished I'd had his car because it was better than mine. But I got through Colorado, made it to Raton Pass, and made it over Monument Hill. And I got to Castle Rock, and Castle Rock kind of sits down in a bowl, if you've ever been there. And I started up, and my car started cutting out, wouldn't make it to the top. And so I just kind of rolled backwards on the shoulder. Good thing nobody was stopped there. And I tried again, and I couldn't make it to the top. I did that several times. I was, I believe, in rush hour traffic at the time. And finally, I just gave up. And I pulled off, and I got a motel. And a motel on my budget is not necessarily the best thing. But they always accept cash, and I had a little bit. So I spent the night there. And I think I got a fuel filter the next morning. I thought that's got to be what it was because I had had a car problem one time before in my life, and it was a fuel filter. And so I put it on. It wasn't the fuel filter. And so I tried one more time, and I finally made it over the top and out of Castle Rock and into Denver, made it out of Colorado and into Wyoming. And if you've ever been to Wyoming, from Cheyenne to Casper, Wyoming, it's just a series of hills. You go up and you go down, and that whole time I would just kind of floor it to get to the bottom of the hill and then all the way up and just barely make it over. It was one of the most nerve-wracking trips I ever went on. When I got back and I took the car to a mechanic, which I am loath to do, not that I know anything about cars, I just hate to pay anybody for it, and it turned out to be a $10 set of points, or less than $10, and plus the labor on that. But anyway, after that, I always had points with me. I could get a flat tire, and I would change the points on that car because I was ready for that. But the thing was, it was just such a small thing, and it almost kept me from getting home. And that's what I wanted to talk about this morning, is how these small things that God has for us are actually very important. But if we can get the little things right, the big things really will take care of themselves. And so Matthew chapter 10 and verse 42 is where I wanted to start, because this particular passage is always just giving me a lot of hope, and it should let us see how kind God is to us, and how little we really have to do in order to get big things. I'm not saying that the standards are low, but what I'm saying is his reward for even the smallest thing that we do is incredible. Jesus said in Matthew 10:42, if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones because he's my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward. God sees just the simplest things that we do. In Matthew chapter 25, Jesus tells a parable to try and help us to see what the end of time will be like and what the judgment will be like. And it's really interesting because of the things that go into the judgment that we might not even suspect were that big of a deal as we were going through them. But Jesus said this in verse 31 of Matthew 25, "When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and all the angels with Him, He will sit on His heavenly throne in glory and separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He'll put the sheep on His right and the goats on His left, and the King will say to those on His right, 'Come, you who are blessed by My Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world.'" Can you imagine what that will be like? To be before God on Judgment Day and to find out that we have made it. We know we don't deserve it, but to find out that we've made it. And then notice what He says in verse 35. "For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me.' And the righteous will say to Him, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?' And the King will reply, 'I tell you, whatever you did for the least one of these brothers of mine, you did for me.'" And I really like that, because God is looking to catch us in doing good. You know, I think sometimes we always get the impression of God just searching the world, waiting for us to step out of line so He can squash us. If that were true, He would have already done it. Isn't that right? He could have caught every one of us apart from Him. He could have sent us to a devil's hell for all eternity if He was just looking for us to step out of line so He could get us. Now, He notices us when we're out of line, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But He sees when we do even the smallest act of kindness for somebody else. And He says, whatever we've done for others, we've done for Him. Another one of the areas of the small things that I believe is really important for us to understand is in the area of salvation. Philippians chapter 2, if you'd like to turn over there, or if you'd just like to listen along, that will be fine. But in Philippians chapter 2 at verse 12, He says this. The Apostle Paul is speaking through inspiration of the Holy Spirit. So these are the words of God. "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Now think about that for a moment. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And now think about how people do that. Because many people are tempted to insert another word in here. Instead of working out their own salvation with fear and trembling, what they want to do is they want to work out their own plan of salvation. And they want to be able to dictate the terms to God. It's kind of like a teacher assigning you homework and telling you, "I want you to do your own work." If he or she does that, what they're saying is, "You're responsible for it yourself. Nobody else can do this for you. It's got to be done by you." But if they said, "Now I want you to work out your own plan of homework," well, that would be easier, wouldn't it? If I got to work out my own plan of homework and they had assigned the first 30 problems at the end of a math chapter, but I got to work out my own plan of homework, my plan would be to, instead of doing those 30 problems, to eat a bowl of chocolate pudding. And then when I got back the next day, I could go to them and I could say, "Look, this was my plan of homework, to eat a bowl of chocolate pudding. I have done that. Give me an A." But if they say, "Do your own work," that's different than come up with your own work. And when God says, through Paul, inspiring Paul, for us to work out our own salvation, He's not saying work out your own plan of salvation. He's saying you work out your own salvation. And then He goes on to really clarify it. Verse 13, "For it is God who works in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure." Maybe a small difference there, but a really big outcome, is it not? We do our own work for God. And when we realize that we are serving the King and not serving for our own pleasure, that makes a big difference, doesn't it? When I was growing up, I was born in 1960, so I kind of just got in on the early part of the hippie revolution, the part where you could see it. I've mentioned this before. My mom and dad one time went to, I think it's to the University of Washington, and we went and looked at the hippies like a family today might go to the zoo. and so I was fairly young at that time, but I remember that they were not exactly a group of people that mom and dad held in high esteem. And a lot of the things that were going on at that time were really getting out of hand. If you'll recall, God had been excused from the public school system in about 1964. No more prayers, no more Bible within the school. And it didn't take very long before there was really a change in the way people were in school. And a lot of those changes were concerning. The parents of the kids within the church, of the young people, the teenagers specifically in the churches, were really kind of concerned about that. And so they thought, we've got to do something for our kids. And so they started bringing in youth ministers, which was a great idea, and having some different things for them to do. But it didn't always work out the way they wanted it to, because sometimes instead of bringing in somebody that was a Bible scholar, they would bring in somebody that was a glorified babysitter who was really good at helping the kids have a really good time. And what they did in many areas was they trained an entire generation to grow up so that they understood that the worship was to be something, a matter of entertainment, instead of a matter of coming to God to worship Him in His holiness. And it wasn't just that. Throughout the centuries, people have wanted to change God's plan of salvation to something that was a little bit more palatable for them, or His rules, and His what He defined as sin and not sin. They wanted to change that, and they've done that. And so now, sometimes the modern day church, you really don't recognize it when you look at the New Testament church, and that can't be. We've got to do our best to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. And when we talk about that, we are talking about working out what God has given us for His will and His work for His good pleasure. And if we'll do that, we'll do pretty good. But even if we change it a little bit, it won't work. Maybe one of the best illustrations of that is in the account of Naaman. Naaman's told about him in 2 Kings chapter 5, and it really is one of my favorite stories in the Bible. When I say story, I mean historical event in the Bible. But 2 Kings chapter 5 in verse 1, we're introduced to Naaman. He was a commander in the army of the king of Aram. Now, Aram was sometimes an ally of Israel and Judah, and sometimes they were an enemy of Israel and Judah, and sometimes they were an ally of one and an enemy to the other. Well, in this particular case, we have Aram, and we have Naaman, who's a commander of the army in verse 1. We're told he was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded. And look at this, because through him, the Lord had given victory to Aram. And so Naaman was blessed by God, and he was given help within battle. It says he was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. And now you can see all the problems that would be associated with that. You take our sports heroes, they're not quite exactly as valiant as a commander in an army, but you can kind of get the connection. If you see somebody that's a great basketball player, or football player, or baseball player, but they have leprosy, well, they're not going to be invited to all the events, are they? They're going to be something of an outcast. And so here Naaman is a great man, but he's got leprosy. And now here is something that's really interesting to me. In verse 2 it says, bands from Aram had gone out and taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. So here she is, a slave girl in Naaman's household. But verse 3 says, she said to her mistress, if only my master, she's talking about Naaman, would see the prophet who's in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy. And so that tells you a little bit something about Naaman, that even a slave within his household would have him in such high regard that she wanted him to get well. And remember, the battles were different back then, and the slavery was different back then. If somebody came against you in battle and they lost, you either killed them or you took them as slaves. That was the penalty for them coming in battle against you. And that's what had happened with this slave girl. But she apparently holds Naaman in high regard, and she wants him healed. And so she tells his wife about the prophet in Israel. And so here's the story after that. Verse 4. Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means, go," the king of Aram said. "I'll send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter I'm sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message, "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there's a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and his chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. And so now we have this. Naaman has come, and he's come with his entourage to Elisha's house to be healed of leprosy. Probably a pretty impressive showing with all the people that have come there. He's an important man. But look what happens in verse 10. Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, "Go and wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored and you'll be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Arbana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" So he turned and went off in a rage. So now we have this. He comes all this distance. He's got an idea of how he's going to be cured, and that idea isn't what happened. He said he thought the prophet would come out to him. The prophet sent a messenger out to him. He not only thought the prophet would come out to him, but he thought the prophet would then call on his God to come and take care of Naaman. So he thought not only was the prophet at his disposal, he thought God was at his disposal. And then he also thought he knew the way that it was going to happen. He'd just wave his hand over the spot and it'd be cured. And that didn't happen that way. Instead, he said, "You go wash, you go dip in the Jordan River 7 times. And Naaman, instead of being delighted at something so easy, he was furious. And he went off in a rage. Well, fortunately, there was somebody with him, another one of Naaman's servants. In verse 13, Naaman's servants went with him to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, wouldn't you have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleaned?" So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan River 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored, and it became clean like that of a young boy. And now notice how Naaman handles things. Verse 15. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, "Now I know there is no God in all the world except in Israel." He wanted something big. He wanted to be treated with honor and held in esteem. And when he felt like he was being belittled, and maybe even humiliated, he wasn't going to do it. But understand this, God does not give his commands to humiliate. He gives them to humble us. And there's a huge difference between being humbled and being humiliated. Being humbled means I know my position before God. Being humiliated is when somebody mocks you and makes fun of you and teases you. That was not what God was doing. But also notice this, as long as Naaman was mad and refused to do this little thing, even though he thought he had a better way, his leprosy remained with him. when he swallowed his pride, and when he did this little thing, dipping in the Jordan seven times, he was healed. And when he was healed, he went to the prophet humbly with his entourage again. And he said to Elisha, "Now I know there's no God except for the God in Israel." Now let me ask you this. Do you think if Naaman had refused to dip in the Jordan River seven times that he'd have been healed? Do you think if he had just dipped six times in the Jordan, he'd have been healed? Or five times? Do you think if he had gone home to the Arbana and the Pharpar rivers he had already decided were much better than the Jordan River, do you think if he had dipped in them seven times or 70 times that he had been healed? Do you think if somebody had sprinkled him with water seven times or poured water on his head seven times from the Jordan that he had been healed? And I cannot imagine that a single person reading this account would come to the conclusion that anything other than the exact word of God was what was required in this instance. And so the question for us then, the connection to us today is this. Why is it that when we hear a command of God, that we think we've got a better way? That we think we know what he really meant by it, even though that's not what he really said, and that we can do it that way, and God will just have to accept us because, after all, God loves us. Why would we think that? On the other hand, why would we not trust in God when we have seen his power and his love time after time after time? The small things matter. We saw in Matthew chapter 24 how they matter for the good. But now let's conclude with the other side of that. Matthew 25, verses 41 through 46, and we'll wrap it up after that. Jesus continues with the parable. Remember, the people have been separated right and left like sheep and goats. Verse 41, he'll say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire." Notice the fire. Notice the punishment is eternal. And it's going to become even more clear in a moment. "Into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels." Hell was not prepared for us. Hell is a prepared place for people who are unprepared. "I was hungry and you gave me nothing. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger. You did not invite me in. I needed clothes. You didn't clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you did not come and look after me." And they will also say, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick and in prison and not help you?" And he'll reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for me," or excuse me, "whatever you did not do for the least of these, you did not do for me." And so we see that the little things for good are going to lead to salvation. We know there's much more than just doing nice things. But this is a huge part of Christianity. How will you attract people to Christ if there's no kindness in your life, no compassion? But just like the small things for God will be rewarded tremendously, the small things that we refuse to do will be punished tremendously. And verse 46, he says, "Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life." Small things matter, don't they? Which will you do? Will you do the small things that God has for you to do, or will you decide you'll do your own thing in your own way, great or small? The difference will certainly be the difference in your eternity. So choose wisely. The invitation is open today. It may be that you're ready to become a Christian today. We would love to help you with that. It may be that you need the prayers of the congregation. But if you need it to respond to the gospel's call in any way, won't you do that while we stand and sing?